The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Of the thousands that are released each year worldwide, what is your criteria for deciding to watch a feature film?
Well, there are two criteria, really. One, if I think it's going to be significant in the culture, either because it's going to be really good or because a lot of people are going to see it, if it's going to be something that people want to know about. And the other one is just interest, the films that I think I'm going to like, the subjects that interest me, the things that I think are going to move me. I'm really less interested in seeing things that I'm not going to like. I'm not very interested anymore in being negative. I mean, I am if I have to be, but I'd much rather push people towards things that I think they'll like.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Kenneth Turan, movie critic for the Los Angeles Times and NPR, about his new book, Not to Be Missed, 54 Favorites from a Lifetime of Film. The origin of your ability to examine films came, in my mind, from a fairly unexpected source, religion.
Yeah. I mean, it was unexpected to me, too. I mean, I didn't realize this until way late in my life that probably this is what had happened. But I was raised in an observant Jewish family, and the whole tradition of looking at text and kind of what does it mean and what can we take from it, this was something that I kind of grew up with. And I think I just look films that way naturally. I mean, I don't look at film a different way when I have to write about it. This is how I look at films. I analyze them. I wonder how they're working. If they're working well, why are they working well? If not, why not? This is just the way I always look at films.
And what was it about the text that you studied as a young boy or a young man? What was it about that process that you started to employ when looking at films?
Well, a lot of it is, you know, just the notion that everything is not on the surface. Everything is not just what you see. There are other meanings here, not necessarily deeply hidden, but just other ways to look at it, other things you can say. You know, the whole notion of the Talmud and, you know, Talmudic exegesis was something that I didn't really go into it deeply, but it informed my father's life, who was very religious, and this was very meaningful to him. And just the whole notion that everything wasn't on the surface. There were things to be gained by looking at it maybe a different way.
Deeper.
Yeah.
In the introduction to the book you wrote, though focusing intently on what I liked and disliked, it gradually became a process of finding out what was important to me on a broader scale, a way to find out, in short, who I am. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, again, as I say, this was also kind of a surprise to me. You know, when you first get this job, you're younger and you're just doing the job and that's really all you're thinking about. But gradually I started to, it started to occur to me that what I liked and what I didn't like reflected on who I was and what was important to me in life. I mean, I tend to like moral stories. I tend to find those moral decisions, you know, exciting, not boring. You know, when people have this real crisis of conscience, I really want to know about that. And things like that, you know, made me think about that. Also, it turns out I love romances. Those are kind of some of my favorite films. So I helped kind of solidify the notion that I'm a romantic by looking at the list of what I like and dislike. So it was things like that. I really, again, it's something that I didn't know about myself, but it kind of makes it clearer.
And choosing 54 must have been a challenge.
You know, it was harder to get the list down to 54 than to write the book. Writing the book was kind of a pleasure. These are films that I love. I saw them all again. It's just a treat to look at them and think about them and write about them. And I researched them, went to the Academy Library and pulled old files. That was great. But getting it to 54, oh boy, that was agony.
You also read a lot of books. I see some references at the end of each chapter.
Yeah.
For books to read and more films to see.
Yeah, I mean, again, the whole notion of this book is to introduce people to things that I think they'll like. So I have at the end of every one of the 54 essays, I have a film to watch next and maybe a book that's related to it. And I have a list of another 54 at the very end. And I have an essay on the 55th film. You know, I kind of am wildly cheating because, again, I just want to introduce people to films they may not have heard of that I think they'll like.
You begin, of course, with silent film, with three films from the 19-teens and the 1920s. So because most of us living today aren't familiar with those films, give us a little background on those.
Yeah, well, some of them are more. The first one is, you know, has very vivid fans, but there are not a lot of them. It's a film called Fantomas by a French director named Louis Fouillade. And it's just, Fantomas was a very significant figure in popular culture. This was these films, which date from 1913, they come from kind of very popular pulp novels of the era. And Fantomas was a master criminal, one of the first of the master criminals, you know, the anti-hero that's more popular than the hero. And he dressed all in black, and he was this criminal, and he had tentacles everywhere in French society. And he just was a figure that transfixed a lot of people when the books came out. A lot of intellectuals were really fascinated by him. And then the films came out. And, you know, I can remember when some of these films, I can remember very vividly the first time I saw them. And I can remember the Fantomas film I saw at the Museum of Modern Art while I was in graduate school. And again, this is 1913. You have to make, very early in the history of film, you have to make some allowances. But there's some visual images that I remember how I felt the moment I saw them. I said, oh, my God. You know, and that's what excites me about Fantomas. And the other two are comedies. And one of them is, you know, most people know Buster Keaton. That's not that unfamiliar. I picked a short called Sherlock Jr., which is a very surreal film. A lot of things happen that are unexpected. Keaton's character is a detective who walks into the screen. He walks into the story. He's a movie projectionist. And he falls asleep, and he walks into the story of the film he's projecting. It's really fascinating. And I paired that with a guy named Max Davidson, who's lesser known, who's an ethnic comedian, the kind of stuff that we don't do anymore. You know, he's an obvious stereotypical Jewish character and got comedy out of that. And there's one film of his that I really like called Pass the Gravy. And so I paired the two of them, Keaton and Davidson.
And I just should mention that the book flows from the beginning. I mean, after your introduction, you start with those early films and it goes through to the first part of the 21st century. The 30s chapter includes films that you label as pre-code. What does that mean?
Gosh, pre-code has become a favorite area of mine. There's a lot of film fans like pre-code, but it's, you know, there was a period in the early 1930s, at the beginning of the sound era. This was after when films learned to talk, and between, so like 1930 through 1934. In 1934, a kind of draconian production code was put into effect, was enforced. This is the famous production code that meant for all the great age of Hollywood, you know, married people slept in single beds and nobody cursed and there was no prostitution and no abortion. They were very much removed from real life. And in the pre-code films, before the code was enforced, none of that was the case. They were crazy. They were out there. They were socially conscious. They, you know, dealt with drug addiction. They dealt with prostitution. They dealt with, you know, some of the stuff that we now take for granted in film and that we think Hollywood never dealt with until today. And it's not so. In the early 1930s, Hollywood dealt with this stuff. And these films are very short. They're very energetic. There's also the excitement of the coming of sound. You can see the actors and the directors just being excited. Oh, we can talk now. People can hear us. So I like those films a lot.
So as soon as people were able to talk and other people could hear people talking, then there arose the objections as to what somebody else was saying.
Yeah, like you shouldn't be saying that, you know.
I'm curious to know why the films from the 1940s and 50s make up nearly half of your list.
You know, it's an interesting question. I selected the films for this book one at a time. I didn't make up a master list. I didn't try and parcel things out. I had a great big list of films that I knew I liked, and then I picked them one at a time, the ones I felt I really wanted to see and write about. And at the very end, my editor in New York said, you know, you got to have some kind of organization for these films. You can't just put them in there in alphabetical order. So I started to think, well, maybe I'll do it by decade. And it turned out to be really revelatory. It surprised me. Again, it just is what you're saying, that so many of my films are from the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And the 1970s, a decade that most people consider to be one of the great decades of American film, I don't have that many films from. But again, I'm really a classicist. I mean, again, that's one of the things I discovered in compiling this list. I like old Hollywood. I like the way they used to make films. You know, that these are my favorites. Believe me, I'm not saying these are the 54 best films ever made. Far from it. But these are the films I would take with me to a desert island. You know, these are the films I can watch again and again and again. And again, the whole thrust of this is to introduce it. I mean, the whole reason I became a critic in some ways is to introduce things, people to things I think they'll like. That's the whole notion.
Children of Paradise, which you've indicated is at the top of your personal list, was made in the 40s. explain why it's your top choice.
Oh, gosh. I mean, that's such an interesting film. I mean, it was made at the end of World War II. It was made under very difficult conditions. Some of the people who made it were in hiding because it was made in Nazi-occupied France. And it was, you know, you can't tell any of this watching the film, but it was really very hard to make. It's an enormous epic film. It's close to 3 hours long. It's a period film. It's set in the early 1800s in France. And it's an enormous romantic epic. It's about one woman and four very different men who fall in love with her and what happens between them, between all these five people. It's just very emotionally resonant. It's just, again, I'm a romantic. I like romantic films. The French make as good romantic films as anyone. And this is, I think, one of the best ones. And it's got a great ending. I was just talking to someone the other day about what it's like to experience that ending. It's just an amazing ending. And it's just a wonderful film.
The way you write about these films, you're not just writing about what happens in the film. You're writing the backstory of who was involved, the director, the actors, the politics of the situation, things that we don't know. And a lot of that is really fascinating. You must have pulled those out of an archive or other books or something.
Yeah. No, I mean, that was part of the pleasure of doing the book, was being able to do research. I mean, I have a lot of books at home on some of these directors and films, and I use those. I went to the Academy Library. The Motion Picture Academy has a wonderful library in Los Angeles that has a lot of files on these things. You know, I started before I was a critic. I was a journalist, and I like finding things out. You know, I like finding, well, you know, if I see something, I like to say, well, how did this happen? Who did this? What were they thinking? What were their problems? And then I find that stuff interesting, and, you know, hopefully readers find it interesting too.
I did.
Good.
Yeah. You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Kenneth Turan, movie critic for the Los Angeles Times and NPR. We're chatting about his new book, Not to Be Missed, 54 Favorites from a Lifetime of Film. If you'd like to hear this program again, look for audio online at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link to it on our Facebook page. Stick around. After a short break, we'll find out why only foreign films made Turan's list in the New Century category. As you mentioned before, you don't have much from the 70s. In fact, in stark contrast to the films that you have listed in the 40s and 50s, you only list two for the 70s and three for the 80s and three for the 90s.
Partly it's the reason I said, you know, I like the classic films. And I was surprised as anyone, really, when I did this breakdown, I had no idea how many films I had for each decade. And when I saw there were only two for the 70s, I shocked myself. I said, oh my, he's like, what have you done? But with the later decades, part of the reason is there were earlier books I wrote about kind of other films I liked. There's one called Never Coming to a Theater Near You about smaller films that, you know, don't always, you know, should probably be seen on at home because they're never going to be at your theater. And I didn't want to repeat too many films from the earlier books. I didn't want to give people the same experience. So there's some films that might have been my favorites that I just eliminated because I didn't want the whole book to be just like the other books. I wanted new films to tell people about.
I saw The Godfather in the 70s, and I think in the intervening decades, I've lost some of what made that film so fantastic. So maybe you can just remind me.
It feels Shakespearean to me. I think the characters in it are so larger in life. The conflicts they have are so intense and go so deep, and they're so understandable. And I just really, it's got great actors. It's got a lot of actors who became huge and really pretty much close to the beginnings of their careers. Actors, they all got bigger. James Caan, Al Pacino, Brando obviously had a big career ahead of that, but Diane Keaton, Robert Duvall, a lot of, you know, interesting actors like Sterling Hayden in very small roles. It's just a great, great story. And, you know, it's one of the films, the story I always feel about it is that if you're kind of channel surfing and you come across it on a channel, you say, well, I got 10 minutes, I'll watch a little bit. You can't stop watching. It's just a completely involving film. And that's really why I love it.
The Right Question features Western authors, so we should talk about Western films. You included The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance and Unforgiven on your list. And Liberty Valance, which was directed by John Ford, about that film you say it undermines the Western myth system, which John Ford himself created.
Yeah, I thought that's one of the things that's fascinating about the film. I don't want to say too much about why that's so, because I don't want to give away, I don't like to give away too much about the plot of films, because I want people to enjoy them the way I did. It tells you that heroism is trickier than you think it is, and what's perceived as heroism and what isn't is not quite always that way. It's a very subversive film in its own way. But the reason it's subversive, I don't want to say, because I'll ruin the film for people. But, I mean, there is that famous last line, which I can say, if I can remember it accurately. You know, this is the West when, you know, legend becomes fact, print the legend. You know, and this is a film that says, you know, we have been printing the legend. And, you know, we should be aware that that's what we've been doing. And again, Ford was a guy who created the legend. He was a very unusual guy to say, you know, maybe we shouldn't be printing the legend. You know, and there's another Western that's on the list that one of my favorites called Seven Men from Now. There was a whole series of films that Randolph Scott made with directed by Bud Bedeker, and they were made very inexpensively. They're very short. They're called the Renown Films because that's the name of the production company. And they're some of the really best Westerns ever made. Seven Men from Now, The Tall T. I'm trying to remember the others. There's like five or six Westerns, and they're just lean, economical, classic Westerns.
Also, Unforgiven is on this list. The screenwriter is David Webb Peoples, and you write that he is intent on de-romanticizing the West. De-romanticizing the West, all the reasons that are inherent in these two films, is that why you put them on the list?
Well, I think they do both. I think that's why they're great films. They are also classic Westerns. They're not just these muckraking Westerns or, you know, iconoclastic Westerns. They also give you the classic Western satisfactions of the hero and the gunplay and the good guys against the bad guys. They have all that stuff, but they've got an additional element as well, and maybe that's why I like them. If they were just tearing down the West, I wouldn't be interested. I love Westerns, but these films manage to do both.
You wrote, "I believe moral choices can be as exciting as the ones in thrillers. I trust in the traditional values of character development and story." Does that explain why your category titled The New Century only includes foreign films?
Well, I was interested to see that it was only foreign films. Again, some of those films that I might have liked were in earlier books I didn't want to duplicate. But, I mean, you know, this is an interesting time for film. I mean, Hollywood is kind of letting us down. Hollywood is not making very many films for adults, especially not big budget films. I mean, yeah, we may never see films like Lawrence of Arabia again. Of course, the studios don't want to invest that kind of money in adult audiences. But as kind of compensation, we've gotten a lot more interesting films from overseas, and they're more accessible to us than they ever were. And we have independent films, and we have great documentaries. So, I mean, I'm very grateful for what we have, and that's part of the reason why I guess those show up on my list, because we see more of them and they're getting better.
The only animated film that I remember was from Japan. So say why that film made your list and something from Pixar didn't make your list.
Yeah, I mean, I love Pixar. I mean, I could have put Toy Story on there. Toy Story is a wonderful film, and the other Pixar films as well. But this film, it's Spirited Away by Hayao Miyazaki, who, I mean, it's ironic you mentioned Pixar because John Lasseter, who runs Pixar, he's a huge fan of Miyazaki, and he's the reason Miyazaki films get to the United States in the first place, because he kind of leaned on Disney to make this happen. Spirited Away is just a magical film. It's very different than any kind of American animation. It really takes you into another world in a way that children really respond to as well as adults. And it's just kind of magical. And, you know, it's interesting. I start the section with this story. I was on the jury at the Berlin Film Festival, and this was one of the films that was in competition. And I saw the film, and, you know, after you see the films, you all get together in a room and you talk about it. And I said to myself, you know, this is such a weird film. No one's going to like this film but me, but I like it so much, I don't care if people think I'm crazy. I'm going to speak up for this film. And you get into this room with the other people on the jury, and it turns out they all felt the same way. Each one of them said, I love this film, but it's going to be too crazy for everyone else. And once we discovered this, the film won the Golden Bear in Berlin, you know, and which was a Japanese animated film. I'd never won an award like that before. So it's an exciting film for me.
So as we mentioned, Not to Be Missed is divided into categories according to decade, with one exception, and that is Orson Welles, who has his own category.
You know, that's so interesting the way that worked out. It was happenstance because the two films of his that I like, I have other directors where I like two films, but they appear in the same decade. Like I like two Lubitsch films, but they're both from, I think, from the 40s. But Welles's films were from different decades, so I couldn't put them into one of the decade things. But it was a great thing for me because Orson Welles is my favorite director, and it was like fate that I got to, you know, highlight him with his own section. Because I think he's the best American filmmaker. I just love his films. And he had such a very kind of up and down, difficult career. People argue whether it was difficult because he was difficult, you know, whether the fates were against him or whether he was his own worst enemy. But the films that he turned out were just marvelous.
Tell the story about meeting him.
Oh, yeah. This is great. You know, one of the virtues of being in Los Angeles is that people live there. And there was some event for Orson Welles. He was being given some kind of, I don't know, honored by some small group. And they asked me if I wanted to come and meet him. And I said, sure, because I like his film so much. And he's sitting in this room. And, you know, it's like a cocktail party. And people are milling about having drinks. And he's in the center of the room in this enormous chair. He was very heavy at the end of his life. And he's sitting in this big chair in the dead in the center of the room. And people are being brought over to say hello to him. And, you know, they bring me over. And, you know, I don't know what to say to him. And I say, you know, I love your films. You're my favorite director. I think you're the best director. And, you know, he just doesn't even respond. So I say, well, you know, you must hear that all the time. And he woke him up and he looked at me and he just roared with laughter. And he said, you can't hear that too often. You know, and I thought that's such a good lesson. Really, people, you think, my God, who, you know, how much praise can they handle? People can handle more.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, creative people are insecure. That's the nature of the beast. I think, you know, a lot of them, even no matter how much success they have, they're still not sure what's going on with them. So I've taken that lesson to heart. When I meet people whose work I like, I tell them. You know, the other person I did that with was Maurice Sendak. I told him the Orson Welles story, and he said, absolutely. You know, you can't hear that too often.
Let's have you do a short reading just to give listeners and potential readers an example of the wealth of information and insight that's in Not to Be Missed.
Okay, this is from a review of Gods and Men, which is a 2010 film from France. Dramatic tension isn't found only in obvious places. Complex moral dilemmas can compel viewers just as easily as heroines in jeopardy or runaway trains. The austere yet provocative of Gods and Men is an adventure of the spirit that's as thrilling as anything James Bond ever appeared in. Directed by Xavier Beauvois and based on the true story of a profound life-and-death crisis faced by a group of French monks in a monastery in Algeria's Atlas Mountains in the mid-1990s, of Gods and Men takes its name from somber lines from Psalm 81. They begin the film and leave no doubt as to the seriousness of purpose of what we're about to see. Quote, ye are gods, and all of you are children of the Most High. Yet ye shall die like men and fall like one of the princes. Close quote. European cinema especially has a history of films dealing with the power of spirituality and belief. You can almost trace a dramatic line that goes back to the magisterial work of Denmark's Carl Theodor Dreyer, The Passion of Joan of Arc, Day of Wrath, or Debt, and includes the more recent films of Belgium's Dardenne brothers, especially La Promesse, in which a thoughtlessly amoral young boy discovers the existence of the difference between right and wrong. Few of these films, however, have caused as much of a sensation as Of Gods and Men did in its native France. Of Gods and Men was a surprising success in France, so much so that the country's major newspapers speculated editorially on the possible reasons. Le Monde was perhaps most eloquent and acute, observing that the monks, quote, incarnate everything that the public, from the left to the right, no longer finds in society. Nobility of spirit, a sense of sacrifice, freedom, sincerity, daily ecology, meditation, reflection on death, close quote. Gone from society and gone from movie screens as well. Which is why this contemplative but emotional film makes the kind of impact it does.
Can you comment on where you think American filmmaking is right now?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, again, we're not in a great position in American filmmaking. Economically, it's not that we don't have great directors or talented people. It's just that, the studios, which have been, for the decades that I love, were really the heart and soul of American filmmaking. They're now run by parts of, and they're part of, and run by large corporations that have a certain demand for profit margin. And so that makes the studios even more risk-aversive. And also they're making films now for the entire world. About 5 years ago, 5-10 years ago, we passed a key point where a given Hollywood blockbuster will make more money overseas than in the United States. This never used to be the case, but now the rest of the world is seeing our movies in greater and greater numbers. So we're ending up making these really the kind of lowest common denominator movies, movies based on comic books, movies based on games, movies based on toys. We all know the drill, sequels. And some of these films can be quite good. I mean, I think Christopher Nolan's Batman films are quite good. But mostly what Hollywood is, concentrating on is not thinking about, the kinds of films that adults, not that adults can't like these other films, but I'd like to see more films intended for adults. And that's kind of going away.
So is it a good thing then that most everybody has access to a digital camera and a computer that can edit?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. If you talk to the people who have to make the final selection at Sundance, this fact that it's so easy for people to make movies is making them a little crazy, because just because it's easy to make a film doesn't mean you're any good at it. And they get a lot more submissions, but really the percentage of ones that are good are not any higher, mm-hmm. So it is a good thing, but it doesn't always pan out. Mm-hmm. Just because you want to make a film and can put something together doesn't mean that anyone else wants to see it.
Kind of like some of the problems in the self-publishing industry.
Yeah, yeah. Again, sometimes self-publishing things are great and find a huge audience, but again, it's mostly no.
What didn't I ask you? What else do you want to say about the book?
I'd like to say a brief thing about documentaries. There's a lot of documentaries in this book. I find documentaries really fascinating. I think we're living, partly because of the ease of production, which means that documentaries don't necessarily cost the earth to make. We're living in a golden age of documentaries. And the documentaries I've picked, I mean, they're so dramatic. I mean, I think people think of documentaries as, well, they're good for you. You'll do serious films and you'll help solve the earth's problems. But really the ones that I pick, they're great human stories. The characters in them, even though they're real, are as exciting and as complicated and as fun to watch as anyone in a fiction film. So I think really more people should give documentaries a try, because they're enjoyable.
I'm all for that. One of my favorite films of all time was a short documentary on kudzu. It was hysterical.
I've heard of that film, but I haven't seen it.
You have to see it.
I can put it on my list.
You get a list of one from me.
Okay, good.
Kenneth Turan lives in Los Angeles, California. There is more about him and his books at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/TWQ. You'll also find links there to our Facebook page. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/TWQ. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.